Blog Talk Radio.
Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed in this show are those of the host as viewed in a public journal atmosphere and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of any fraternal order.
Now, Blog Talk Radio has a new switchboard, so bear with me as I figure it out. Today's guest is Brother Dave Letellier, the owner and founder of the Phoenix Masonry Masonic Museum and Library. He's currently on the line. Let me see if I can tag him in. Hello, Brother Dave. Can you hear me?
Yes, greetings, Brother Hall. How are you today?
Great. How was the weather down there in Florida, over there?
Well, we have bounced into spring here, and unfortunately everything's in bloom, and we have a little bit of a cold spell coming, which is going to knock all the flowers off of the bushes and trees. So, once the pecans start to come out, we'll know it's spring for sure because they never get fooled.
And right here in Wisconsin, it's 4 degrees. So
that's insane. I don't know how anybody could live in such conditions.
Well, I keep telling my wife because of my back problems, it's time to move so to some place that's more that got a better weather. So.
I can understand that.
Okay, getting into today's topic, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for calling in. The call-in number, if anybody want to ask a question, is 646-649-0008. And getting right into the show, I have a couple points, a couple questions I would like to go over. First question, how did you become interested in Freemasonry?
I became interested in Freemasonry. I kind of grew up in it. Both my father and grandfather were Masons with the mainstream jurisdiction here in Florida. And I used to go to a lot of covered dish dinners and different D-Malay and Rainbow Girl and other events, was when I was a teenager. I never did join D-Malay, and it wasn't until many years after I turned 21 that I actually became a Mason. But, college and work got in the way initially, so I didn't become a Mason until I turned 35, which this year, makes my 25th year.
So if anybody would like to go check out your website, they can go to www.phoenixmasonry.org. We'll be going through some of things that you have. You mentioned mainstream Freemasonry. For those who don't know, are you making the distinction between mainstream and something else?
No, not really, other than I don't think a lot of people realize there are many different obediences and jurisdictions within Freemasonry. I use the term mainstream pretty loosely. That's pretty much what they call themselves. It's actually Malecraft Masonry because they're for men only. But I belong to a mixed-gender lodge now, which admits men and women into Freemasonry on equal standing.
Well, I get a lot of questions about Freemasonry. Personal friends ask me about Freemasonry or joining, and I tell them, well, first of all, go find out what kind of Freemason you want to be, because like you just said, they think it's just one. So, okay, next question. When did you know you wanted to collect Masonic items?
Well, I became a Mason in in 1990. And no sooner than I had joined, I was in the cabinet business. I'm a cabinet maker by trade. And I used to have to go on different appointments set at different times with homeowners. And in between times, if I was out of St. Pete and down around Bradenton or headed north up to Tampa or points north, I used to hit all the little antique malls and stores, and I started running across items that were Masonic in nature, and that's what sparked my interest, because some of the stuff that is, which we call collectibles now, were actually the very beginning of a lot of pin trading and card trading and spin coin trading, things that take place, a lot of the trading things that take place, were actually started by Masons who were trading their souvenirs when they went to conclaves and Imperial Council sessions all over the United States. So it has a rather interesting beginning, and there's quite a lot of material out there, especially from around the turn of the century when Masonry was at its peak.
And you also mentioned of a shrine glass from Syria Temple.
Well, that was actually my first piece. I found a 1910 champagne glass that had two hand-painted alligators walking up the side, and there was a picture of King Mardi Gras on the front impressed in the glass. And these glasses were made in special molds. There's what they call two-piece molds, three-piece molds, four-piece molds. Well, two- and four-piece molds, especially two-piece molds, are kind of common. But a lot of these glasses were either hand-blown from glass or made from three-piece molds, which were actually, quite unique. And a lot of people don't realize that there was a huge cottage industry around the turn of the century where a lot of the women, even though they couldn't go out and really hold down, male-type labor in jobs, a lot of them stayed at home and they hand-painted porcelain and pottery and glasses. And that was how they made a living.
And this is, I'm looking at the link that you sent me that I will try to get up also to go with the audio. It's a beautiful piece, too. I wonder how they made it.
Well, that was a three-piece mold, which is very, very rare. It was made by the Westmoreland Glass Factory just outside of Pittsburgh. The entire Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Ohio area is real big they were at one time, in making glass and pottery. And that particular piece, one of the things is the glasses changed from year to year depending on the destination where the Shriners would go to hold their Imperial Council sessions. And they tried to hold the theme of whatever city they were going to. They tried to make it into the glass. So, of course, King Mardi Gras and hand-painted alligators on the side of the New Orleans glass was, kind of a standout feature. In 1905, when they went to Atlantic City, that glass has a mermaid and some of the first clipper ships, a clipper ship on it that they used in the America's Cup races. When they went to Rochester, New York in 1911, the side of that glass has a cameraman taking a picture of a Shriner on a camel coming into town. And that's emblematical of Rochester being the home of Kodak Camera. So there's a lot of these different themes that run through the glasses for the destinations of where they were going. And other shrine temples used to make collectibles, and they used to trade for these glasses. In other words, there are quite a few of these glasses around, primarily because they made more than the actual membership of the lodge or the temple. They actually made extras that they could trade. Now, a lot of other Masonic collectibles are a lot more rare, primarily because they were individually made to the size of the lodge. If the lodge had 50 members, then they would have 50 cups, mugs, glasses, coins, tokens, or whatever made. And, you know, those were items that weren't necessarily traded. They were kept by the individual Freemasons that attended the event, whether it was a lodge dedication or an anniversary, something along that line.
And you've been collecting for over 25 years.
About 25 years. This year will be my 25th year. And, of course, it's an OCD thing just like anything else. Once you get started on it, you get really passionate about it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and that's how I kind of got into the museum thing. It was actually self-taught. But as I started buying things for my personal, you know, collection, things that that interested me, I wanted to share that, and I was the first curator of the museum at the Masonic Home of Florida in St. Petersburg, and that museum is still there. A lot of the hand-painted aprons and things like that that I went to Jacksonville and got out of their vault are still hanging there, you know, in the boardroom of the Masonic Home. So starting museums was kind of the next thing on my list, but the Grand Lodge of Florida at the time didn't want to spend any money on an internet museum, and that's when I took it on myself to start Phoenix Masonry and start a Masonic museum so that brothers and sisters nationwide, could view some of the things from days gone by. And it really turned out to be successful, primarily because static museums just don't get the traffic. Young kids today, especially the millennials, are traveling with their phones. There's a big rush by museums and libraries everywhere now to get all of their books and all of their artifacts, you know, pictured and described online, because they get 100 times more traffic.
Yeah.
We tried to start a static museum in Salt Lake City, but the problem with it was that it didn't get enough visitors, and it was too expensive to maintain.
Right.
Whereas on the internet, after 15 years now, we get anywhere from 60 to 70,000 unique visitors per day.
And when looking up Phoenix Masonry, also came upon other museums, and you're absolutely correct. A lot are starting to go to the way of getting online.
We were actually the first Masonic museum, and then shortly behind us, the Livingston Masonic Museum and Library started posting their collection. And, you know, we're a part of the Masonic Library and Museum Association, and we used to go to their conventions every year, which we don't anymore. But that's primarily because, you know, we have to pay for the cost and the transportation personally. It's not like being a curator or a librarian at a Grand Lodge, whereas, you know, they're going to the convention and it's all paid for by, you know, the Grand Lodge. It's not an out-of-pocket expense. So that's why we don't travel anymore. We've been to several of them, and we still maintain our membership in the MLMA, but we don't travel to the conventions anymore.
And being for 25 years of being in it, have you ever had a problem or dealing with being burnt out or no?
It's hard to get burned out on the collecting thing. Actually, what gets burned out is all the time spent at the computer. People don't realize, you know, the skills involved in being a webmaster, where you're spending thousands and thousands of hours taking pictures of items at different angles. Mm-hmm. You've got to edit all of those photographs. You got to write descriptions for everything. And you can only do that kind of thing one day at a time. And I was also working at the time. I had my cabinet shop, and I did kitchens and bathrooms. So I pretty much had to make a living and then work on a lot of this other stuff on the side. So I could only put a couple of hours a day into it every day. But excuse me. But after 15 years, okay, just that little bit of a piece or two a day adds up. And now the museum has 2,500 to 3,000 pieces on view, on display.
How would you describe your museum?
Well, the museum is actually a collaboration between several private Masonic collectors. And we all met on eBay back in the early, not the early 90s, about the mid-90s, when eBay was just starting to come about. And we were not only initially competing with each other, bidding against each other on eBay, but after a while we all realized that, hey, look, there's enough of this stuff to go around. Let's just, you know, get to know each other and give everybody an opportunity to collect what they want. In other words, there's plenty of Masonic items out there. There's no sense to, you know, run the price up on someone else if you didn't have to, especially another brother.
Yes.
So we started working as a team on a lot of these things. And when we came about with the museum in August of 1999, three of us that used to, you know, buy and collect on eBay got together and started the Phoenix Masonry Masonic Library and Museum.
So you do have a board of directors?
We do have a board of directors. Unlike in your introduction, you called me the owner. I do own, I really don't own the corporation. The corporation is run by a board of directors. Okay, I am the president of the board, okay, and Frederick Milligan, who a lot of people know very well, is our executive director. Elena Lamas is our publicity director. Both of them are working on other projects, by the way. That's how come you're doing the podcast with me today. Fred is working on a couple of book reviews, and so is Sister Elena. So we're pretty busy, and we all have to, you know, maintain our regular day jobs. And then, of course, what we do for corn, wine, and oil. There's no pay for what we do, and we're all volunteers. So, you know, that's what gives us the money. You know, what little money that we do get, okay, helps us to pay our website fees and things like that. But none of us take a salary, not even me as webmaster.
Now, if you had one favorite piece that you could say that is your favorite piece, what piece would that be?
Well, my favorite piece is a Bohemian hand-blown decanter. That's it's not acid etched. It's copper wheel engraved. And when you make reference to Bohemia, we're talking about Austria and that area, that part of Europe. And this decanter dates back to the 1790s. And that decanter we've had on loan for the last couple of years to the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, and it was on display in their museum at George Washington's home at Mount Vernon. So we just recently got that back, and but they did a presentation on George Washington being a Freemason. And it was well received, and they're thinking about doing it again, and we'll probably need the decanter again, you know, to put on display. But I think one of the most unique things about the decanter is the copper wheel engraving that's on it. It has a lot of different forms of symbolism. Things that you would see on an old firing glass, a lot of the same symbolism, and they're just one of a kind. And George Washington was thought to have the same decanter set, so you know they're trying to recover a lot of Washington's estate. Anytime they come across pieces that were in the original inventory of the Mount Vernon estate, they spend big money on trying to get it back. Because when George Washington passed away, all of his personal property was put up for auction and sold.
Well, now, do you have a most memorable item?
I would say one of the most memorable, I was in an antique mall in St. Pete, and when I go into, you know, most antique malls, the first thing I do is I ask them if they have anything Masonic or of that nature, because it's kind of hard to search an entire antique mall for specific things. And this lady brought out a broken-up olive wood box with two crystal bottles, one that had oil in it and another one that had wine in it. And the center compartment was empty, but there was still a card inside the box saying that this wages box was made in Jerusalem, and it was a gift from the U.S. consul there that ran the embassy in Jerusalem to the U.S. consul in Malta. So we have the original card that went with this wages boxes. And the wages box, of course, is, you know, given to a fellow craft mason as he passes through the middle chamber. And he's taught about, you know, its representation of corn, wine, and oil. So I had the box, you know, rebuilt. In other words, all the pieces were there. And, in fact, I glued it up myself in the shop and put what was essentially in this bag wrapped in old cotton. The bottles were wrapped in old cotton. I put the box together and had the card, you know, from the U.S. consul in Jerusalem to the U.S. consul at Malta, you know, put into a frame. And that's probably one of the centerpieces of my personal collection. And, you know, to find it in the shape that it was and then put it all back together was kind of exciting. That's what makes it memorable.
Right. Do you have, what is the biggest item you have?
Well, some of these things can get pretty big, especially when you're talking about, you know, there's all kinds of areas of things that you can collect. And if you start collecting things like lodge furniture, you come across old furniture, you know, like pillars of Boaz and Jachin with the globes on the top.
Yeah.
Okay, some of that stuff is absolutely massive. Okay, but in the glass and pottery line, which is pretty much, you know, what I collect, I like you know, the lady portrait plates. I like all the Knight Templar commandery things, especially things that they did for ladies' night banquets, you know, in the early lodges. They really did take a lot of time to, you know, keep the women happy. So a lot of their souvenirs that they traded were the kind of thing where they just didn't have the square and compasses on it. They would have a beautiful picture of a lady, you know what I mean, that be hand painted or printed onto the plate. And because a lot of these women couldn't travel to conclaves and imperial council sessions, the men would bring these things back as gifts, and the women didn't have a problem with staying at home and, you know, having these nice gifts come back to them. but I think the heaviest thing we have is we have an old Paducah whiskey jug. And the interesting thing about that is that what makes them so rare is most of them were broken during Prohibition. And, you know, we happen to have one in the collection, and it weighs about 35 or 40 pounds. It's like a crock, and with a, you know, a handle on it, but it's really an oversized whiskey jug, and it has the square and compasses on the front of it that that the merchant, you know, had printed on the front of them. Now, of course, that's not allowed these days, but back then, you know, if a man was a Mason, he was a business owner, he was pretty proud of it. And they used to put the square and compasses on a lot of the products that they made and sold. A typical example of that is S.J. Addis, who was a toolmaker in England. He made all kinds of chisels and different metal working tools, squares, compasses, and he has the square and compass logo without the letter G on the back of every tool that he ever made.
Wow. What are some of your future plans for the museum?
Well, we're going to try and maintain status quo. You know, we keep adding, you know, new things that we come across. One of the things that we do try and keep an eye out for are actual folk art pieces, because they're generally one-of-a-kind items. And, you know, we're a Mason, a little old guy, went out to his shop in the back of his house, and he worked for weeks and weeks and weeks, you know, carving and making a table and doing all kinds of fancy inlay into it, or making a Masonic ship in a bottle, or putting entire lodge scenes together inside of a bottle.
Wow.
Some of it's pretty intense. And if anybody ever gets a chance to visit the museum in Lexington, Massachusetts, where the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite has their museum, it's called the Museum of Our National Heritage. And it is absolutely a fantastic place. The curators there, Amy Newell and the other girls, are just, you know, fantastic. And they also have a wonderful collection of items. And you might actually want to do an interview and a podcast with them someday, too.
Oh, that sounds great.
Because they have a lot of interesting items. We're trying to save the material culture of Freemasonry.
Yes.
And we think that's kind of important, okay, that brothers and sisters 100 or 200 years from now can look back on us, and they can see how well we polished our ashlars, you know, through our material culture as well as our personal lives.
So the rest of this podcast can be downloaded and heard through the podcast section. We got a few minutes left from the live version is about to end. So to hear the rest of it, you can go to the podcast section and download that. Brother Dave, do you want to speak a little bit about the library portion of the Masonic Museum and Library?
Well, our library now, even though we have a library with over 10,000 books, we have taken, I would say, almost a couple of hundred of them, okay, and had them individually scanned page by page, converted into digital readable type, and they're all online and linked. Some of these books, we tried to pick them. A lot of books are being posted online now by different universities, which are just scanning their entire libraries. So we try and pick and choose certain books that a lot of the college libraries might not have. A prime example of that is the Masonic History of the Northwest, which talks about all the Masonic lodges west of the Mississippi River and, you know, in the formation of the early West, because there was a Masonic lodge in every town, okay, which was also the community center and the polling place, just about anything that they, you know, needed to do was done on the first floor of the Masonic Lodge. I mean, the lodge was set up usually on the second floor, but the first floor was generally, even in the old days, was a huge dining room.
Yes.
Because the meetings were either preceded or followed a meeting. And so we try and pick special books, okay, like that one in particular, the history of the Masonic History of the Northwest, because it's well over 1,000 pages. And if you go to download it, even with a high-speed DSL connection, it takes 2 or 3 minutes to load it. But we've got all the graphics, all the pictures, and all the text. And I really need to give credit to our previous librarian, worshipful brother Ralph Omholt, who lives in Washington State. He was the one that did all of that work. And then we also have the complete series of the Builder magazine, and that was also scanned by another brother before he passed away. I'm trying to think of his name offhand. Maybe someone can help me with that. But he put an awful lot of work into scanning 12 issues a year, 15 years of the Builder magazine. And he did all of that. He was just unbelievable, you know, what he was able to put together.
And I can only imagine,
it's a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah, and I can only imagine the cost of ink.
Yeah, if you print them out, yes, but we weren't printing them out. What we were doing is we were scanning them and putting them into PDF formats and HTML text so that, and a lot of stuff we try and keep in HTML text. That way, if anybody goes to the Phoenix Masonry Masonic Museum and Library, everything there is free for any Masonic lodge to use for their trestle boards or Masonic education of any kind. You know, there's no admission to the museum. There's no charge to go in and cut and paste whatever you need for your trestle board in the way of Masonic education. What it is, it's a huge free universal resource that anybody, even the general public, can go to if they want to learn anything about Freemasonry. It's at our site.
Wow. So how can they get to your site or your social media by way of...
Well, we do. We have taken on other forms of social media here within the last year. Our publicity director, Susan Elena, or sister Elena, what she has done is she's hooked us up with Reddit and Instagram, Tumblr, Pinterest, and other social media sites, and you can find pictures of different artifacts and things at those sites, but those sites are primarily for mobile users, and but the bulk of the museum and the library is online at our .org domain.
Well, Brother Dave, I would like to thank you for calling in to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Brother Hall. I really appreciate your invitation, and maybe we can do another interview in the future sometime.
Oh, for sure. Anytime you get new information or a new piece, just give me a call, let me know, and we can set something up.
Well, thank you, brother. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you, too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And for my parting quote for the day's show by Louisa May Alcott, preserve your memories, keep them well. What you forget, you can never retell. Until next time, Lexi Tenebris.